it is one of the most shocking sexual abuse trials the world has ever seen. Over nearly 10 years, Dominique Pellicot drugged his wife and invited at least 70 men into his home to violently rape her while she was heavily sedated. Gisèle Pellicot could have remained anonymous, but in 2024, she chose to have an open trial. And with that, a movement of supporters rallied around her. Her bravery instantly made her a global feminist icon. Gisèle Pellicot released her memoir this week, telling her side of that harrowing story. And she also gave her first interview to American media, speaking with Lulu Garcia Navarro for the Interview podcast by the New York Times. I spoke with Lulu after she'd returned from Paris. Lulu Garcia Navarro, thanks so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
It is my pleasure.
It was a compelling interview. It was a haunting interview. It was a shocking interview. Before we get into the content, I just wondered how you go about preparing for that kind of conversation.
I have spoken to a lot of survivors of sexual assault. I was a longtime foreign correspondent, worked in many conflict zones. So unfortunately, I've had a lot of experience with that. But I did not know what to expect with Gisèle Pellicot, simply because, first of all, I don't think I've ever spoken to someone who has gone through what she's gone through. The scale of it, the horror of it, and the fact that she doesn't remember any of it. The most important thing for me was to respect her voice. And, you know, we did that in a lot of different ways. We had an all-female crew for the most part. And before we actually sat down to speak, I warned her that I would be, at least on one occasion, talking about something quite explicit that she'd written about in the book so that she could prepare herself. I didn't tell her what it was going to be, but I wanted her to know that there would be something explicit.
And with a story of this magnitude and a story of such horror, did you feel a great burden, a special burden of responsibility at being entrusted with the retelling of her story?
I did. Huge responsibility. And it's funny, since it's gone out, that has only increased because so many people not only saw her as a heroine, saw her as an icon, as someone who had really flipped the script on women's shame, on the story of abuse that we often hear, where women hide, they're sort of run out of town, they're broken. She became something else. But it also speaks to women's own experiences. And so through her, they see themselves in a lot of ways. And so I knew that this was going to be very heavily scrutinized. And I just wanted her to be able to feel comfortable enough so that everyone could hear what she was experiencing in her own words and how she made sense of it. Not just the facts of it, but also what was going on in her interior life. And I think what came out was just this extraordinary interview. We spoke for almost 3 hours, and she was just luminous and candid, and at every turn wanted to make sure that she was being heard and understood.
I was struck by one of your opening questions because the answer seemed so revealing.
How would you like me to refer to your ex-husband?
Monsieur Pellicot.
Monsieur Pellicot.
What struck you about her response?
Well, I asked her that because I didn't know what she'd say. This is not only her ex-husband, this is also her abuser, her rapist. I've spoken to victims who don't even want me to mention that person's name, or they want me to refer to them as simply the abuser or the person who did these things. So, you know, for me, it showed that she wanted him to be known. She still, even though she's legally changed her name in public, she still carries the name of her ex-husband. But at the same time, she wanted it to be very clear that there was a distance there. He is Monsieur Pellicot. He is not my former husband. He is not all the names that she used to call him, obviously, when they were married. And this was very formal and, you know, very clear that this was someone who was no longer in her life.
One thing that came across very clearly in the early phase of the interview was the intimacy of that relationship, the love of that relationship. It was seemingly a happy marriage. It was interesting to hear her speak sort of respectfully and almost wistfully of her husband.
Yes, she talked about the joie de vivre, the joy of life that she experienced with Monsieur Pellico, how they would always laugh together, how they were known as a very happy couple, engaging with a good social life.
All our friends and family liked him. He was always ready to help. He was athletic. I only knew a kind and caring man, which is terrifying.
This was 50 years of her life, you know? And I think the thing for me that was so painful and yet so interesting is how she made sense of that. You know, she talked about separating the bad memories from the good ones. And she said it was like sorting laundry. You have to throw away the things that are soiled and keep the things that are clean. Because she said if not, she'd be left with nothing. Those 50 years would have all been a lie. That's her entire life. She's been married to him since they were teenagers. And so I think she's had to really work through what she wants to keep of their marriage and what she wants to throw away.
In big stories, there are often small and telling details. One of those was when she first realized that something was wrong. She felt very drowsy. And she actually asked him, "Are you drugging me?"
It's such a chilling moment. She, in the interview, told me that sort of early on, she was having an episode where she just wasn't waking up. And she woke up at like 6 o'clock in the evening after having slept the whole day. And it was very unusual for her that, you know, she'd been a working woman most of her life, very active. And so she found it very strange. And she went to confront Monsieur Pellico.
He was in the garden at the time. And I said to him like this, "Doumé, my nickname for him. You're not drugging me, are you?" As if I was asking him what he wanted to eat or if we were going for a walk that afternoon. In other words, my subconscious asked the question, but as if I were joking. And then to my great surprise, he cried. He said to me, "Do you realize what you're saying to me? What are you making me out to be?" His response completely threw me off balance.
She says now that she thinks it's her subconscious sort of knowing what was happening to her or suspecting that something was happening to her.
I was struck by how composed she was, especially in the early part of the interview. But as you spoke of some of the details of the awful things that happened to her, there was this moment where she did break down. And I just wonder how difficult that
was. Why did
was.
I do it?
No, I totally understand why, but it was a difficult moment and it was almost an inevitable moment.
Well, I think, you know, I actually think there is a question why. There's a big discussion, and we had it editorially, about re-traumatizing victims and having them have to sort of relive difficult experiences. The thing about Gisèle Pellico is that, of course, she doesn't remember any of this. And if you'll remember also during the trial, she didn't cry once, famously, sort of was incredibly stoic. And in the book, she writes that she felt that she had to be invincible, that she sort of didn't want to give her rapists anything, didn't want to crack in front of them at all. And I think since that trial, she's been processing in a different way what happened to her. And so when I quoted her a line from the book, the reason I did that is because for me, it encapsulated so much. It wasn't only the horror of what had been done to her, but it also was the gaslighting that her husband was doing to her at the time. You know, a crown comes loose in her mouth and she doesn't know why. And he's saying, "Oh, you probably bit off something." And he's being solicitous and he's helping her. And meanwhile, he knows exactly what happened. And so to me, it was this one thing that I couldn't get out of my head in the book. Like, I just kept coming back to that moment. And to me, it said so much. And I just wanted the audience to know what had happened. And to be honest with you, I wasn't even expecting her to tell the story. I didn't need her to. It was more that I was just letting people who were listening know exactly what she'd gone through. But she decided to explain how she'd felt and what she'd seen, and it was indeed a very powerful moment.
It was incredibly violent. They spared me no humiliation.
Do you want to take a moment?
Ça va. Non, ça va.
I'm sorry
non.
For what
Il
happened
faut que
to
les
you.
Gens sachent. C'est très important que les gens sachent.
People need to know. It's very important that people know.
On Radio National, Saturday Extra, I'm Nick Bryan. I'm speaking with Lulu Garcia Navarro, the host of the interview podcast on the New York Times, about her compelling, her moving interview with Gisèle Pellico. One thing that struck me about the interview was a lot of the men who raped her are still at large. And she does not know whether these men are still part of her life, whether she will bump into them in a street or bump into them in a cafe.
Yeah, that's of the many haunting things of this, one of the things that really is very sobering for her. She said after she found out about what had happened, and pretty immediately it was known that they couldn't identify 20 to 30 of the men who had done this, that it had consumed her, that she didn't know if she was going to bump into them. And she had this one encounter with a random man while she was eating at a restaurant with her lawyers, who bought her a meal.
I was lunching with my lawyers before heading back to the courtroom in the afternoon. And they tell me, your meal has been paid for. I said, no, that's not possible. And they say, yes, by the man over there. So I went to thank him and asked him where he lived, and he lived not far from Mazan. Once we had finished talking, I said to my lawyers, what if he is one of my rapists who wasn't arrested?
And imagine walking around in the world and having that be the case, that your rapists, people who have done the worst things to you, you could be passing them on the street and you'd never know who they were.
Another thing I learned from the interview was that she is going to meet her husband in prison.
I think this is one of the things that's really difficult for victims, and especially Gisèle Pellico, because she describes her husband as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, that there was this face that he presented to the world, to her, to their children, and then there was this monster lurking underneath. And I think she still hasn't been able to reconcile that. I think she's still trying to understand who this man that she had lived with for 50 years really is. And I don't know that she'll get those answers, but she feels very strongly that she wants to look him in the eye and confront him. She wants to have that happen. And so she thinks she'll do it at some point this year.
One of the questions that has haunted me and a lot of other people is this. There's nothing remarkable about that French town where these awful things happened. And if it could happen there, presumably it could happen anywhere. Her thoughts on that question were interesting, I thought, because she didn't deliver a sort of blanket condemnation of men.
No, in fact, she was very careful not to. She feels very strongly that clearly what the evidence shows is that there are a lot of men, if given the opportunity, would do something like that. I mean, all the men who raped her lived within 30 miles of her house. They all lived in the area. And it's not because that area is particularly known for rapists. But at the same time, she was very clear to say, not all men are rapists. We cannot think that that is true, because then where does that leave us? So she just refuses to, you know, give up her faith in human nature and mankind. She just will not say that she is broken in that way. And I think that was the thing that I heard from many women, how really inspiring they found that, that she just won't say that everyone is bad. And if she felt that way, we'd be like, I understand why you feel that way. But, you know, she's able to sort of say this man was bad. Those were bad men, but not all men are bad, which is such a powerful thing to be able to say. It invites men into this conversation in a way that I think is really, really compelling.
And proof of that has come from the fact that she has found love again.
I met her partner. She brought him, and he's really, really lovely. I will say, and just so supportive to her. She seems very much in love. And they met in the period between her finding out what had happened and the trial. There was a 4-year period. She moves to this island, and she meets a widower, and they start to have a relationship, and they fall in love. And again, many people that I heard from said, oh, I was going into this conversation bracing myself for the horror, sort of whole, you know, just really thinking, oh my goodness, this is going to be grueling to listen to. And instead, what you come away from is just how riveting her story is, how the change in her is extraordinary. You know, she said, I was a regular woman, a working, you know, mother. I wasn't a feminist. There wasn't anything remarkable about me to become this extraordinary figure that she's become, and to find love and to find hope in that love. And, you know, to say that whatever happened in the past, she still has life in her, and there's still things that she can enjoy. And she's looking forward to, you know, having a partnership and having a beautiful relationship with somebody else.
You were talking about journalistic justifications for revisiting trauma. And I think one idea we often cling to is that we've helped in some kind of catharsis, that the retelling of the story can be helpful to the victim. Did you sense that at the end of the interview?
I don't want to speak for Giselle, but she did tell me at the end that she was grateful for the opportunity to speak. And she did hug me, and she did say that she felt my interview had been different than the few others that she'd had. And so that was meaningful to me. I don't know if it was cathartic. Certainly writing the book was cathartic, she said. But I do think she feels that there's a mission behind why she's telling her story, that there's a purpose to it, that it's not just to sort of horrify people or to show them, as they say, trauma porn, that she really wants people to understand what happened to her and, you know that you can survive the absolute worst things in the world, and not only survive them, but come out the other side of them and point the finger at the perpetrators and not feel like you yourself are defeated. And I think that is just an extraordinary and compelling and beautiful message that I was really happy to have her be able to deliver.
Lulu Garcia Navarro, the host of The Interview from The New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
My pleasure.
And you can listen to the interview at the New York Times website. It's an extraordinary conversation.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.